either had no sleeves at all or sleeves like bells that fell past their wrists. They were taller than Buck women, and not even the dark-haired ones had curly hair. Some of the men wore only vests over their bared chests, and their trousers were as short as the women's skirts. I supposed it made sense in that warmer climate, but to me they appeared half-naked. They were lighter-skinned than Six Duchies folk, and taller, and for once my pale hair drew not a second glance. I saw not a single beggar. As we left the wharfs and warehouse and inns behind, we passed some of the pink and pale yellow buildings I had seen from the ship's deck. There were flower boxes below the windows and benches by the doors. Shutters were opened wide on this fine day, and I saw rows of spinning wheels in one pink building, the spinners hard at work, and heard the clack of looms from the shadowed room beyond them. We passed a building that breathed out warmth and the smell of baking bread. Everywhere I looked, I saw cleanliness and order. It was not at all what I had imagined Clary's would be. Given how cruel Dwalia had been, I had imagined a whole city of hateful people, not this pastel prosperity. There was other foot traffic on the road with us. As in the port part of the city, the folk hurrying along beside us were a mixed lot. Most of them were light-haired and fair-skinned, and dressed in the garb of Clary's. But some were plainly foreigners and travellers from afar. Mixed in with them were men and women in guards' garb, wearing a badge with a twining vine on it. Many of them stared openly at Dwalia's ruined face, and some appeared to recognize her, but no one offered her a greeting. Those who seemed to recognize her looked shocked or turned away. For her part, she did not offer good day to anyone, and set a pace that meant we passed most of our fellow walkers. Our path toward the White Island led us along the shoreline. Water lapped on the beach. Grey and white sand sparkled over bones of granite. We walked on a smooth road, past houses with vegetable gardens and arbours between them. I saw children, all dressed in the same sort of smock garments, playing in dooryards or sitting on the steps of the houses. I could not tell if they were boys or girls. Dwalia strode on. As she walked, I watched her tug the final pins from her hair and let her braids hang lank about her face. She took off her necklace and lifted the earrings from her ears. I almost thought she would toss them aside, but she tucked them into her bag. With them gone, all traces of Lady Obricia vanished. Even her fine gown became an oddity rather than lovely. To my surprise, I became aware of her feelings. She did not simmer and boil as my father had. My father's thoughts and emotions had always surged against my senses. They were why I had first learned to make walls within my mind. Dwalia's were not nearly so strong. I think I sensed them only because for so long I had pushed tendrils of my thoughts into her mind. It was, as Wolffather had warned me, a way in was also a way out. And now her thoughts seeped through to me. I felt from her a resentful anger that she had never been beautiful and had never felt loved, only tolerated. Because she was useful. I felt her heart wander back to a time when she had known love once and loved in return. I saw a tall woman smiling down on her, the pale woman. Then, as if crushed under a fall of icicles, that feeling stopped. The closer we drew to the island, the more I sensed self-justification that was rooted in anger. She would force them to acknowledge that she had not failed. She would not allow them to mock or rebuke her. And she would have her vengeance. As if she felt the brush of my thoughts against hers, she glared back at both of us.
"Hurry up," she snapped. "The tide is going out. I want to be there early, not caught in the crowds of petitioners. Vindelire, walk with your head up. You look like an ox going to slaughter. And you, little beech, keep your tongue still while the four are listening to me. Understand me? Not a sound from you, or I swear I'll kill you."
It was her first rebuke to me in several days, and it startled me. Vindelire did lift his head, but I think he was more encouraged by her spitting venom at me than at her order to him. Clearly I had fallen from her favour, at least back to his level. Vindelire still waddled when he walked, but he waddled faster. I dreaded the meeting with the four, and longed to ask questions about them, but kept my tongue stilled. Several times Vindelire glanced over at me, as if almost hoping I'd ask him. I didn't. A few times my secret plan tried to seep into my thoughts. I damned it back. I was going to be happy here in Clara's. I would have a good life. I'd be useful here. When I felt Vindelire looking at me, I turned a vacuous smile on him. I wanted to laugh aloud at his startled face, but I restrained myself. We left the houses behind and walked past a very large building of white stone. There was nothing of grace about it. It was entirely functional. There was a large stable beside it, with its own smithy, and there were several open areas where sweating guardsmen were performing drills. The shouted commands of their instructor echoed from the building's side, and dust rose around the guards as they lunged, clashed, and retreated in turn. Then we entered a section of the town that reminded me more of the Winterfest booths than a true village. Sturdy stone cottages had shade awnings in front of them, and people stood in queues before them. In the shade, under the awnings, people paler than me with fluffy white hair sat in embellished chairs that were almost thrones. Some had tiny scrolls to sell. Others had the same sort of cupboard as the man who had told us to find the sea rose. Some of the sellers wore exotic scarves and sparkling earrings and vests of lace. Others were clad in plain shifts of pale yellow or rose or azure. One had a large crystal ball on a filigreed stand and was staring into it with eyes the same color as a trout's. A woman stood silently before her, clasping a young man's hand. There were other vendors there, selling charms for luck, or pregnancy, or sheep fertility, charms for good crops, or to help the baby sleep at night. These wares were cried loudly by younger versions of the merchants, who moved about the crowd carrying trays, their voices as shrill and incessant as the gulls over the harbour. There were food stalls, too, selling foods both sweet and savoury. Their tempting aromas reminded me that we had eaten at dawn and walked a fair pace since then, but Dwalia did not pause. I could have spent the whole afternoon exploring that market, but she strode through it without a pause or a glance to left or right. Once I heard a hushed whisper. "I'm sure it's her. It's Dwalia." Someone else said, "But where are the others then? All the Lurics on those fine white horses?" Not even that turned her head. We hurried past and through folk standing in a thick line, and some cursed at us and others shouted at us for being rude, but Dwalia threaded through the crowd until we came to the head of the line. A short causeway of stone and sand ended in a tall gate made of iron bars. Just beyond the gate, the causeway ended abruptly in water. Beyond that water, on a stony island, was the white stronghold. Before the gate stood four sturdy guards. Two held pikes and stood staring stonily at the queuing people. The other two wore swords. They were formidable warriors, blue-eyed, dark-haired, and well-muscled, and even the women were taller than my father. But Dwalia did not pause or hesitate.
"I am going to cross."
"No, you are not."
The man who spoke did not even look at her.
"You are going to go back to the end of the line and wait your turn. When the tide goes out and the water has receded completely, then we will admit pilgrims in an orderly fashion, two abreast. That is how we do this."
Dwalia stepped closer and spoke through clenched teeth.
"I know how we do it. I am one of the Circle. I am Lyngstra Dwalia, and I have returned. The four will wish to hear my report as soon as they possibly can. You should not dare to detain me."
She gave Vindelire a sideways glare. I felt him try. His thin magic lapped against the guards. One cocked his head and looked at her carefully.
"Dwalia."
The guard spoke it as a name he knew. He lifted an elbow and nudged the woman next to him.
"Is that her? Dwalia?"
The other guard grudgingly shifted her gaze from the queue of anxious pilgrims to study Dwalia, the wrinkles in her brow growing deeper as she did so. Then her eyes fell on Vindelire.
"She left here a long time ago.
rode at the head of a troop of white horses and riders. Could be her, but she looks different in that dress. But that one, him I recognize. He is Dwalia's creature, Vindelire. He does her bidding. So if she has him, then I guess it's her. We should let her cross.
But now, while the water still runs over the causeway, it's not that deep. I can tell. I wish to cross now.
Dwalia's tone brooked no argument.
Open the gate for me.
They stepped back from her, conferred briefly. One scowled and seemed to indicate her fine dress, but the other shrugged, and he was the one who unlatched the gate and swung it open. We had to step back to allow its motion, and that crowded us into the waiting petitioners. And when the gate was clear, and Dwalia stepped forward with Vindelire and me following, the crowd moved with us, trying to cross with us. The guards with the pikes moved forward, crossing their weapons and pushing them back. We stepped forward alone. The causeway was of smooth-cut stone, flat as a table. Dwalia didn't pause when she reached the water's edge. She did not lift her skirts or take off her shoes to carry them. She walked forward as if the sea did not still own that space. We followed. The water was shallow at first, not warm, but not numbingly cold. As we went forward, it got quickly deeper, soaking my shoes and moving past my ankles to my shins. I began to feel the tug of the ebbing tide. Beside me, Vindelire was scowling.
I don't like this,
he said bitterly. Neither Dwalia nor I paid him any mind, but I soon began to share his uneasiness. The water got deeper and the pull of the receding waves stronger. I had waded in creeks and streams, but this was seawater. It had a smell and a stickiness that surprised me. The opposite gate on the far end of the sunken causeway had not looked very far away when we began. Now, as the water rose past my knees and up my thighs, the safety of the far shore seemed to retreat. Even Dwalia slowed as she sloshed forward. I fixed my eyes on her back and fought the weight of the water. The tide might be ebbing, as they had said, but waves still came and went, and sometimes they wet me to my waist. Vindelire had begun to make an anxious noise, between a hum and a whine. He was falling behind. When I glanced back and realized that, I tried to move faster. The water was colder now, and I panted as I pushed my way through it. Leave him behind, I thought fiercely. I think he felt my wish, for his wail grew louder, and I heard a splash as he stumbled, and then his hoarse cry as he surged to his feet again.
Drown!
I arrowed that thought at him, and then shut myself behind my walls. The sun beat down on my head, scorching my scalp through my short hair, while the water pressed against me and drew warmth out of my feet and legs. I folded my arms high on my chest and hugged my bundled clothing to myself. I pushed my thirst to one side along with my aching muscles. Shipboard life had not prepared me for today's hike. The sunlight bounced off the water and into my eyes. I lifted my head and tried to see Dwalia, but glittering light dazzled my eyes. I began to feel shaky and ill. Was the water shallower? Perhaps. I took heart and surged on, head and shoulders bent as I fought the waves. When next I lifted my head and looked for Dwalia, she stood at the far gate, remonstrating and cursing the guards who would not open it to her. Beyond that gate, a huddle of people awaited its opening to leave the castle. Their weary stances and aprons of leather or fabric proclaimed them to be servants of the servants, probably on their way to their homes. I sloshed up behind Dwalia. She astonished me by swiveling about, seizing me by my collar, and near lifting me off my feet to shake me at the guards.
The unexpected son, she snarled at them. Do you want to be the ones who delayed his arrival before the four?
The guards exchanged glances. The taller man looked back at her.
That old myth.
Vindelire came shuddering up beside us. One guard nudged the other.
That's Vindelire. No mistaking that treacherous little gelding. So she is Dwalia. Let them in.
Dwalia did not release her grip on my collar as the gate opened and we passed through. I tried not to resist her pulling, but it meant walking on my tiptoes. I could not look back to see Vindelire following, but I heard the thud of the barred gate as it shut behind us. a road of dun sand stretched before us. The sun wore sparkles in it. It was straight and featureless. To either side of it, a barren and rocky landscape spread. It was so flat and empty that I knew that the hands of men had shaped it. Nothing could cross this expanse of ground and not be seen. Never had I seen an area so devoid of small life. The only relief to the eye were occasional stones, and none of them was larger than a bushel basket. Dwalia suddenly released me.
"Don't dawdle and don't speak," she ordered me, and then set off at her distance eating stride again.
Her once fine skirts were wet and slapped against her legs as she walked. I followed, trying to match her pace. When I lifted my eyes to stare at our destination, it dazzled me more than the sunlight on the water. The white walls of the castle glittered. We walked and walked, and seemed to come no closer. Gradually, I began to realize that I had greatly underestimated how large a fortress it was, or castle, or palace. From the ship I had seen 8 towers. This close to it, when I looked up, I saw only 2, and the misshapen heads that topped them looked like skulls. I slogged along, head lowered as the sun pounded down on us, eyes half closed against the brightness. Every time I lifted my head, the aspect of the immense structure at the end of the long road seemed to have changed. When we were close enough that I had to crane my neck back to see the tops of the towers, the ornate bas-reliefs on the outside of the walls became evident. They were the only marks I could see on the smooth white walls. From this vantage, I saw no windows, not even arrow slits, and no doors. On this side of the castle, there was no access at all, yet the road led directly to it. White on white, the etched carvings were many times taller than a man, and glittering even brighter than the walls they graced. I stared for a moment, and then had to look away and close my eyes. But when I shut my eyes, there the carvings were again, inside my eyelids, like a climbing white vine. I recognized it. Impossibly, I knew what it was. I remembered it from a life I had never lived, or perhaps from a future I had yet to see. That vine had crawled through my dreams. I'd drawn it on the front page of my journal to frame my name. I'd given it leaves and trumpet flowers. I'd been wrong. It was an abstract representation. And there was a thought I'd never had before, that an artist could create a picture of an idea, and I would know what it was. I recognized it as the river of all possible times, cascading down from the present and splitting into 1,000, no, 1,000,000, no, an infinite number of possible futures, and every one of those splintered into another infinity of possible futures. And among them all, a single gleaming thread, incredibly narrow, that represented the future as it could, should, and ought to be. If events were guided correctly, if the white prophet dreamed and believed and ventured forth to put the world on that path, time would follow it. I opened my eyes again, for I had only closed them a moment. There it was again, before me. And despite all I had come through, all I had endured to come here, and how much I hated the people who had brought me here, I suddenly felt a lift of belonging. I was here at last. A certainty rose in me, clearer than anything I had ever known about myself. I was supposed to be here, in this place and in this time. This was where I was supposed to be. 12 dreams I had had suddenly spun and then interlocked with more recent dreams inside me. The vague plan was no longer vague. I'd felt a similar surge of certainty on the day I had freed my tongue. I'd seen the paths with such clarity only once before in my life, on that fateful day in winter when the beggar had touched me and I'd seen how all futures began at my feet. Oh, the great good that I could do. Now that I was here. My fate was here, and only I could shape it. It stole my breath away, and as I gazed, I felt my heart lift, just as the minstrels described it could happen. I was here, and the great work of my life was before me. I realized I had stopped only when Vindelire trudged past me. He looked at me with a gaze full of venom, and I found I could not care. A smile pulled at my mouth. Walls up.
Bee, hurry up!
Dwalia snapped the command over her shoulder.
Coming,
I replied, and something in my tone made her halt and look back at me. I cast my eyes down and bowed my head. This was not a thing to share with anyone. I needed to hold it close inside me. The knowledge was like a glittering stone scooped from a filthy puddle. I saw the shine of it, but I knew that the more I handled it, the cleaner and clearer it would become. And like a jewel, if I revealed it, thieves would take it from me in any way they could. I heard a sound behind us and looked back. The tide was out, and the causeway stood above the water. A snake of people, 6 or 8 wide, now packed the narrow belt of road that ran between the waters. Some were almost across, but even after they reached the island and the waters of the bay no longer hedged them in, they did not spread out, but kept to the narrow causeway.
Hurry!
Dwalia urged me again. No wonder she kept us to such a rapid pace. If we did not keep up our speed, they would overtake us, maybe even trample us. Ahead, where there had been only smooth wall, cracks appeared, startling black against the white. The cracks became the edges of the doors, and then they opened wide. A phalanx of guards, clad in gleaming silver armor and pale yellow cloaks, marched out and formed up in 2 rows alongside our path. I thought they would halt us, but Dwalia glared at them and made a sign with her hand, and we strode past without a word. It was not until we had passed under the arch of the entry and emerged into a courtyard that a man stepped in front of us. He was tall and thin and wore a sword, but even in his armor he looked skinny and weak. His face was pasty and blemished, with splotches of pink, peeling skin. Tufts of graying hair stuck out the sides of his helmet. He narrowed his eyes.
Lyngstraw Dwalia!
He made her name an accusation.
You left here with a mounted guard of Lurics. Where are they and their fine steeds? Why do you return alone?
Step aside, Boss Fodi. There is no time to waste. I must have audience with Symph and Felody immediately.
He held his place a moment longer, his gaze wandering over her damaged face, inspecting Vindelire's ragged garments, and then settling on me. His frown became a grimace of disapproval. Then he stepped aside and made a grand gesture for us to pass him.
Go as you will, Dwalia. Were I coming back from a doubtful quest, scarred and stripped of all that had been entrusted to me, I doubt I'd be in such a hurry to report my failure to the fore.
I didn't fail,
she replied tersely. As we hurried past him, he muttered,
Of all the ones to come back alive, it had to be Vindelire.
I heard him spit. The wide courtyard was paved in patterns of white and black stone and was as clean as if it had been recently swept. Lining the inner walls of the outer keep were food and drink stalls alongside bright carts with multiple drawers that would, I now knew, hold fortune papers inside nutshells. Pennants and garlands hung nearly motionless in the heat. Open-sided pavilions shaded tables and benches that awaited hungry and thirsty patrons. It looked like a celebration, far larger than Winterfest at Oaksby Water. For one instant, childish curiosity made me forget who I was now, and I longed to wander among the booths and buy sweets and bright gewgaws.
Hurry up, stupid!
Dwalia barked. These joys were not for Vindelire or me. I walked away from the child I had been. She hurried us toward the finest structure within the fortress walls. It was built, apparently, of white ivory. The doors and windows were a filigree wrought in bone or stone. This stronghouse was the base for the 4 slender onion-bud towers I had glimpsed from the ship. It looked impossible for such towers to be so tall and support such pinnacles. But there they were.
Come!
Dwalia snapped at me, and for the first time in some days, she slapped my face. I felt the old split at the corner of my mouth bleed again. I lifted a hand to press it closed and followed her. Double doors stood open beyond a columned portico. We ascended wide steps to reach them. The cessation of sunlight beating down on my head and shoulders was a shock. My shoes were still damp. I tracked grit from the wet causeway onto the immaculate floor. As my eyes adjusted to the light, I became aware of the magnificence that surrounded me. Here, the doorways were edged with gilt, or perhaps real gold. Brilliant paintings in opulent frames, the subjects many times larger than life, graced every wall. Tasseled tapestries hung on the upper walls. I had never seen white wood, but every wall in here was panelled in it. I lifted my eyes to see that even the high ceilings were painted with incomprehensible landscapes. I felt very small and out of place in such grandeur. But Dwalia was uncowed by any of it. The woman who blocked our way was robed in fabric of rich yellow, yellower than dandelions. Her sleeves hung slightly past her wrists, and her full skirts brushed the floor. The collar stood up to her chin, and her flowered headdress left only the circle of her pale face showing. The red of her painted mouth was shocking.
"Dwalia,"
she said, and waited, scowling. In the distance, I heard a door open and then shut. Two people walked past us and out of the door. As they exited to the pavilion outside, a roar of voices reached my ears. The crowd had reached the outer courtyard. Then the closing door cut off their sounds. Dwalia spoke.
"I must have an audience with Simph and Felody immediately."
The woman smiled nastily.
"This is not a day for private audiences. The four are in the judgment chamber, prepared to hear grievances and assign blame and penalties. You must know those appointments are made months in advance." "But,"
she smiled like a snarling cat,
"perhaps I can manage to get you an appointment."
At those words, Vindelai's hands flew to his cheeks and then covered his mouth.
"No, I wish to see Simph, alone or with Felody. Only those two. At once, Denise."
Dwalia gave Vindelai a glare. He dropped his hands and then hunched his shoulders as if expecting a blow. The woman in yellow folded her lips, leaving her face all but featureless, for her eyes were grey, and as I stared at her, I realized that she had no eyebrows.
"It can't be done today. Perhaps the day after tomorrow I can—"
"If you make my news wait 2 days, I think the four will slowly remove your skin. Or perhaps allow me to perform that task myself."
I had thought Denise was as pale as she could get, but her face turned as white as my father's good paper.
"I will convey your request to their attendants."
"See that you do,"
Dwalia interrupted.
"We will await their summons in the Joy Chamber. See that refreshments are brought to us promptly. We have come a long way."
"You do not command me,"
the woman said, but Dwalia only snorted.
"Follow,"
she ordered Vindelai and me, and led us from the circular entry hall down one of the corridors, branching off it like the spokes of a wheel. We walked on spotless white stone past disapproving portraits. Behind us, I heard the outer doors open and looked back to see Denise greeting a procession of finely dressed folk. Dwalia moved down the hall with great familiarity. When we came to a door adorned with brass insets of multiple suns, she pushed it open and we followed her in. I trailed curious fingers on the door as I passed it. It looked as if it had been made of large panels of bone or ivory, but what creature would have bones or tusks that large?
"Shut the door,"
Dwalia snapped, and I snatched my hand back from the panel. Vindelai was behind me, and he pushed it closed. How long had it been since I'd stood still inside a room that didn't shift with the waves? I took a deep breath and looked around me. It was a room designed for waiting and discomfort. Two milky white windows admitted filtered light, but no view. Chairs of hardwood with straight backs lined the walls. A bare table of white wood sat in the centre of the room. There was no cloth on it, no vessel of flowers such as my mother would have placed. The floor was hard white stone, and the walls were featureless white wood panels. Massive white beams crossed the ceiling overhead. With the door closed, no sound came from outside. Dwalia saw me looking around.
"Go and sit down," she instructed me.
I was extremely thirsty, and I needed to pee, but I knew there would be no opportunity to appease either need. I went to one of the chairs and sat. It was too tall, and my feet dangled. Uncomfortable. I tucked my small pack of bundled clothes behind me. It didn't help. Dwalia did not sit. She walked slowly around the room like a rat travelling the walls. Vindelire shuffled along behind her until she abruptly spun about and slapped him.
"Stop that!"
He caught his breath on a sob, glared at me, and then took the chair farthest away. He sat on the edge of it, his toes on the floor and his heels jiggling soundlessly. She pointed her finger at him.
"Nothing left? You have no power left at all?"
His lower lip trembled.
"You well know it has seldom worked against those with a strong measure of white blood. I could not sway Denise. Besides, I had used so much for you on the captain and crew. It was a lot of work."
"Be quiet."
She opened the top buttons of her blouse and fished in her bosom. She pulled out the leather pouch, and Vindelire's eyes lit as she took the glass tube from it.
"It is fortunate I saved some. You must convince the four to listen to me, and believe me."
His face crumpled.
"All four? It would be hard. It would be hard even if I had a full dose. Coltrane. I might be able to sway Coltrane, but..."
"Be quiet!"
She had unstoppered the tube, but when she tipped it, the coagulated mess in the bottom didn't shift. She pushed the stopper back in and shook the tube. The clog in the bottom didn't move.
"We are damned," she said.
She opened the tube and thrust a finger in. It was too short to reach the clot in the bottom. She could not touch the residue. She shoved it at Vindelire.
"Spit in it, then mix it and drink it."
I watched as he drooled saliva down the tube and then tipped the tube to try to mix it. I felt my gorge rise and looked away.
"It's not working,"
he wailed.
"Break the tube,"
she ordered him. He tried. He tapped it on the floor. Nothing happened. He tried again, harder and harder, until suddenly it shattered. The serpent slime was a dried-up wad. Vindelire picked it up and, heedless of the glass splinters that clung to it, put it in his mouth. Dwalia waited, staring at him. He breathed out hard through his nose. When he spoke, blood flecked his lips.
"Nothing,"
he wailed.
"Nothing at all."
The blow Dwalia dealt him snapped his head on his neck and he fell to the floor. He sprawled there, his breath faltering in and out. She walked away from him and sat down in one of the chairs. She did not utter a word. Eventually, Vindelire got to his knees and crawled to a chair not far from mine. He pulled himself up and sat in it like a pile of soiled laundry. No one spoke. We waited. No one brought the refreshments Dwalia had demanded. We waited and waited. The late afternoon sun struck our obscured windows, making a rectangle of soupy light on the featureless floor. The door opened. Denise, the same woman who had admitted us, appeared.
"You will be seen in the judgment chamber. Now."
"The judgment chamber? That is not what I told you I wanted."
Denise turned and walked away without waiting for us to follow. Dwalia motioned me sharply to her side and seized my shoulder in a hard grip.
"Say nothing,"
she reminded me. She pushed me along in front of her. The pace she set did not allow me to glance back. We followed Denise back to the entry chamber and then down a different corridor. This one was broader and more elegant, and we walked a much longer distance, my bladder aching at every step. At the very end of the corridor, stood two doors with four shining symbols embedded in them. Even in the muted light of the hall, the symbols gleamed. Perhaps they meant something, but to me, they were just shapes in blue, green, yellow, and red. Denise pushed a brass handle, and the doors swung wide. The room was brightly lit, white sunlight streaming in from four openings in the ceiling, and I blinked at the sudden brilliance. Dwalia pushed me past and through spectators, who stood motionless and silent. I stumbled forward over the polished white floor. When she halted me, I lifted my eyes to behold an elevated dais with four thrones of carved ivory upon it. One throne sparkled with rubies, another with emeralds. I did not know what jewels were so yellow and blue on the other two. Could there be that many jewels in the world? For a moment, that question distracted me from the occupants of the chairs. Two men, two women. One woman was young and beautiful, with pale skin and hair of white gold. Her lips had been painted red, and her brows and lashes were lined in black. It was a startling beauty rather than a comfortable one. Her pale arms were bare, and her torso encased in red silk so tautly tailored to her that she might have been naked and merely painted red. Her full skirt was black and reached to her knees. Scarlet sandals framed her feet, the laces crossing and recrossing her calves. I thought her clothing looked painful to wear. The woman who sat next to her was very grand. Her cascading hair was white and unbound and straight. Her eyes were a very faded blue, and her lips were the pink of an old rose. She was dressed in a pale blue robe that was as simple as the other woman's scarlet garments were complicated. The pearls that roped her throat and dangled in strings from her ears and wrapped her wrists were all of a size and gleamed warmly. The men flanked the women, one at each end of the arc. One was painted like a puppet, his skin white and his hair molded to his scalp with white powder. His eyes were dark, those he could not disguise. His jerkin and leggings were dark green, and the rich cloak he wore was the green of spring ferns. His dark gaze was distant and thoughtful. At the other end of the arc was a portly man. He was pale, his hair more white than yellow, but his clothes were all gloriously yellow. Buttercups and dandelions and daffodils could not rival all the shades of yellow in his garments. His hands rested on top of his belly, and each finger was graced with a ring of gold or silver, even his thumbs. Thick hoops of yellow gold hung from his ears, and a flat golden throat piece began under his chin and spread in plaits over his collarbones. I stared at them in puzzlement. The gaudy thrones and their elaborate separation of colors made them seem almost comical. To either side of the dais, two very large guards held spears. They stared impassively at the gathered people. I realized the green man was glaring at me. At the same instant, the pressure of Dwalia's hand on my shoulder drove me crookedly down. I fell to one knee and then got my other leg under me. I glanced to one side and saw that Vindelire was already kneeling. Past him, I saw a row of pale folk lining the wall. Their garments were loose tunics and trousers in light hues. Hair that was barely blonde, eyes nearly colorless, like the butterfly messenger my father and I had burned. Dwalia remained in a deep bow until one of the women on the dais spoke. I heard her years in her voice. She sounded disgusted.
"Straighten up, Lyngstrad Dwalia. Your bow is more insult than respect. You have returned after sending us no word for many months. Fitting that you come to us in the judgment chamber. Where are those we sent out with you? Lurix and steeds gone? Stand straight and explain yourself."
My hair hung over my brow and down into my eyes. I peered through it as Dwalia spoke.
"Honored ones, may I tell you my tale from the beginning? For it is a long and complicated path I have trodden. There have been losses, grievous losses, but those lives were not wasted, but surrendered to buy us exactly what you sent me to find. I bring to you the unexpected son."
She seized the back of my collar, and I was jerked upright, as when someone lifts a pup by the scruff of his neck. I stared at the four in surprise. Their expressions were startling. The red woman looked intrigued, the old woman angry. The white painted man appeared startled. The man in yellow leaned forward and looked at me, his eyes gleaming as if I was something delicious presented to him. He frightened me.
"Oh, must you?"
The old woman said the words as if Dwalia had picked at her nose and presented the results to her. Her skepticism and disdain were manifest. She shook her head slowly and, turning her head toward the painted man, said,
"I told you it was dangerous to let her take those lurics out into the world. She has lost them all and dragged this ragamuffin back to us as if it was some sort of treasure. A sorry excuse for her failure."
"Let her speak, Capra," the lovely woman said. Her voice was taut with anger, but I could not tell if it was directed at Dwalia or the woman seated beside her. The older woman let her gaze travel over the people who lined the room. Their eyes were avid to witness Dwalia's downfall. Capra lifted her skinny arm. The bracelets of pearls dangled as she swept the room with a pointing finger.
"All of you are dismissed. Begone!"
I continued to strangle in Dwalia's grip as the spectators slowly filed from the room. I heard the doors thud closed. Capra scowled at someone.
"Doorkeeper, include yourself in my dismissal. We have no need of you here."
There was a second, softer thud as the door closed again. I twisted my head to look. All gone. We were alone in the room with the four and their burly guards. The old woman's gaze came back to Dwalia.
"Continue."
Dwalia released my collar, and I was glad to sink back down. I heard her draw breath.
"Very well, my ladies and lords. 3 years ago, you provided me with companions and horses and funds to allow me to set forth to find the unexpected sun. Some had claimed that the time of that prediction was past, that we had already endured his meddling with the streams of time, and that the best we could do now was to work with the threads we had. But in light of a flurry of dreams about a new white born in the wilds, and peculiar dreams that related to the unexpected sun, some of you believed I might discover him, and—"
The powder-faced man interrupted.
"Why do you begin by telling us what we already know? Were not we there? Do you think us simpletons or senile?"
The woman called Capra scowled.
"She must believe us simple if she thinks that I will not recall that I most ardently wished her to find and return to us the traitor Beloved. That was why I agreed to your quest, to bring back to us the prisoner whose escape you aided."
"No, I do not think you foolish. No, I but wanted—" "Let me tell you then the full tale of my journey, for I think that if you hear of it, you will begin to share my conviction."
I could feel Dwalia struggling to collect her thoughts and speak them well.
"You will recall that my studies had led me to believe that a man who had once served the Duke of Chaelsed was the necessary tipping point for the events I wished to trigger. Thus, while some of my lurics both delayed and aided Beloved to lead us to our prey, the first task of my quest was to go to Chaelsed. Having long studied the dream prophecies, I was certain of my interpretation. I needed to enlist the aid of this man, Elik. Only with his aid and the service of the men loyal to him could I hope to follow Beloved to what we sought. I found Elik. I showed him the power of my acolyte, Vindalaya, and—"
"Be done with your time-wasting,"
Capra barked the words.
"Tell us what became of the lurics we entrusted to you. The finest of our creation, the ones with the most promise. Where are they, and the fine white steeds from Coltry's stables that went forth with you?
Was the silence long, or did it just seem so in the dread I felt?
Dead. All dead.
Twalia spoke the words flatly. I opened my mouth at her lie. Alaria was sold into slavery, not dead, and how could she be sure the others had all died? What of the one who had been left behind with Shun?
Dead?
The woman in red was horrified. Her perfectly painted mouth hung open in horror.
Are you certain of their deaths?
Yellow leaned forward over his belly, setting his palms on his round pink knees.
Did you burn their bodies? Tell me you did not leave their bodies to fall into curious hands.
Green was horrified. Capra clapped her hands together, and the sound was startlingly sharp.
Account for them! Account for every one of them! How did each fall, and what became of each body? Tell us this now!
Another pocket of silence. Dwalia spoke more quietly. A strange calm had come into her voice.
We had penetrated the 6 duchies, completely unremarked. With Vindelire's aid and prescience, we crossed that land unforeseen until we found the youngster. I was, as part of my mission, tracking Beloved as well. He it was who led us to him, the unexpected son. We were able to take him, we, that is, Vindelire, blinded their minds to us. We left that place, knowing they would not even remember that such a child had ever lived among them. All was going well. We were so close to boarding the ship to return here. But there was an attack upon us. We were scattered. Some I saw fall. Others fled. Some few I gathered to me. I dared a magic that I did not trust or understand.
They fell. They fled. How can you be sure that they died? How can you be sure that our secrets were not betrayed when they were captured? This is unconscionable.
Capra turned her wrath on her fellows.
Do you see what you have done? Do you understand now? You sent the pick of our Lurics, those with the best white blood, the best potential for breeding and for dreaming. Ordinary soldiers were not good enough, no. You had to send our finest. And now they are gone, dead, scattered who knows where, taken as slaves, living as beggars, selling dreams for food. And who knows who might use them against us?
She turned her fury back on Dwalia.
You were tracking, Beloved, tracking, blinded, lamed, and the best you could do was track him? What became of him? Where is he?
If you would let me tell my tale,
Dwalia began. Her voice was thickening. Tears? Fear? Fury? The pasty-faced man in green had been shaking his head slowly through their exchange. Now he spoke.
Capra asks the most important question last. Where is Beloved? You promised that you would bring him back to us. That was our condition for allowing you to free him and use him. You say it was part of your mission. I say it was the heart of it. You promised to bring him back alive to us, or proof that he was dead. Do you have that with you, at least?
I heard the small sound it made when Dwalia wet her lips. Again, she measured her words carefully.
No, I do not have proof, but I am certain he is dead by now.
She suddenly stood a little straighter and met his gaze.
It came about exactly as I had deduced it could, and I made it happen.
Her voice rose, and her words made my belly fill with ice.
You doubted me. You mocked me and said my ambitions were far beyond my means. But I alone studied his dreams, and I alone put those pieces together.
I knew that I could use Beloved to lead me to the unexpected sun. And he did. I alone manipulated events to make that happen.
I felt dizzy as I tried to reconcile her words with all the snatches of information I had gleaned in our travels. The words Dwalia had spoken collided with the words I had read when I had pilfered my father's writings and delved into his secrets. Beloved. I closed my eyes, for the man in yellow was licking his mouth as if he could barely restrain his enjoyment. The beautiful woman's eyes flamed with a cruel delight. Even the pale, painted man's mouth had fallen open in astonishment. I closed my eyes so I would not have to witness their pleasure at my father's pain. And behind my closed eyes, my own pain ignited. A marketplace beggar, the man who had touched me and shown me all the futures, the man my father had stabbed, the man he chose to help even though it meant abandoning me, was Beloved. He had been the fool, the white prophet, the oldest and truest friend my father had ever had. All my suspicions confirmed. I had so longed to be wrong. I was sick, sick with knowledge of how I had been part of that betrayal, at how I had prompted my father to stab his oldest friend. And I was dizzy and weak with the realization that it was all real. They could do it, Dwalia and these whites. They could sift dreams and make the future become what they wanted it to be. They could lever my father into killing his friend and then leaving me, because they could give my father what he had wanted so much more than he wanted me. Was his fool, his beloved, dead? Or were they together? Was that why he had pushed me away? To make room in his life for his old friend? Bile rose in the back of my throat. If I'd had any food in my belly, I would have vomited up onto their perfect white floor.
Proof?
Capra's voice was quiet. Then it rose to a shout.
Proof! You promised us proof! You promised you would see him dead or bring him back. I warned you, all of you, how dangerous a creature he was, and is for all we know.
She had turned to look at her fellows.
And you conspired against me, all of you, in this foolish experiment.
Compose yourself, the beautiful woman said in a low voice.
Oh, compose your own self, Symph.
The old woman snapped. For a moment, they glared at each other like squabbling kitchen maids.
This disaster is your making. You and Felody cooked it up and served it to Coltrane, and he was gullible enough to believe you and side with you. I'd measured Beloved when first he was brought here. I knew what he was capable of from the beginning, and I warned you, all of you. I kept him at my side. I watched him. I tried to change him. And when I knew he would not be changed, I warned all of you. We should have done away with him then, when he would not silence his own questions. But no, you wanted his bloodlines, and Felody wanted more than that of him, mooning after him like a lovesick ploughboy. So you overruled me. Me, who had actually spent time with him and knew how determined he was to be the White Prophet, to change the world. Was not it bad enough that he escaped our keeping the first time? That he smashed all we had so carefully built and planned for half a century? Gone? Our pale woman, our beautiful Illistor and Keeble Rawbread, and the damned dragon set loose again? How could you have forgotten all that? But you did. You ignored all that Beloved had wrought and all he had destroyed the first time he escaped our keeping.
I turned my head slightly and could see that Vindelire knelt, his head bowed tight to his chest, as if he could make himself smaller and less noticeable. Beside me, Dwalia looked like a cat pelted with rocks. Her eyes were slits and her mouth was dragged down as if she had a fishhook in her lip. On the dais, the three bore the old woman's wrath with varying degrees of displeasure. I could tell they had heard this rant before, but none dared interrupt it.
We had him here!
Her voice rose to a screech.
Beloved! Such a name for such a traitor! We could have simply held him here.
He'd come back of his own volition. We could have kept him isolated, even kept him comfortable. We could have made Beloved believe we forgave him and that his tasks were accepted by us. Even after you discovered how he was corrupting our lyrics and sending them away from Clarice, you still refused to see how dangerous he was. I said kill him, but no. Dwalia, jealous as ever, insisted that he had a secret. And when no pain tore any secret from him, when all you won from him was the name of his lover, you still refused to listen to me. You three thought you were so clever. Allow him to think he's escaped, you said. You said he was too weak to go far, that you could reel him back in at any time. I said no, I forbade it. But you overrode me. You called me foolish and old. You put him back out in the world and concealed that deed from me for months. And when I discovered it, more lies from all of you.
She seemed drunk on her own fury and righteousness. Instead of calming, she was a storm still building.
You, Dwalia, you promised you would follow Beloved and he would lead you to his secret. But at the last he eluded you? Or did you choose to let him escape you?
She pointed a trembling, skinny finger at Dwalia.
So set aside for now those lyrics you led into slaughter. Set aside the priceless white horses and even the elixirs you squandered on your experiments. Where is Beloved?
Dwalia lifted her head. She spoke with contained but unconcealed anger.
Dead. I am certain he is dead. Just as dead as you wished him to be. And he died the way I wished him to die, at his lover's hands. Over and over, Fitzchivalry Farseer sank his knife into Beloved's belly, for he did not even know him after all I had done to change him. No healthy man could have survived such wounds, and Beloved was poisoned and blinded and broken even before he took them. I had made sure of that.
Dwalia stood taller.
So I am certain he is dead, and by allowing his catalyst to take Beloved's dying body, I drew them both away from my prey, from what they both had guarded and thought they had well concealed.
Once again, she jerked my collar and hauled me to my feet.
I tell you, this is the one all those prophecies foretold. And,
she shouted the word as Capra opened her faded lips to speak,
and I believe this child is not only the unexpected son, but that she carries Beloved's bloodline. The bloodline that Symph and Felody and Coltry so wanted to develop. I bring this to you. I, Dwalia.
Her eyes roved over them, and in a low voice she added,
Do you recall when you would not let me go with Illistor? When you sent her out without me, with no one to guard her back? Just as I have succeeded with this, I tell you plainly, had I gone with her, she would never have fallen.
She held me displayed for them, a rabbit she had snared. The lavishly dressed man in yellow looked at me and said in a low, awed voice,
She does have the look of Beloved about her chin and the set of her ears. She could be his get.
She?
Capra bellowed at him.
Do you know the word, Felody? Do you hear it? Do you understand what it means? Often I have wondered if you know the difference between male and female, or if you care. This is not the unexpected son. The best she might be is a bastard daughter of a treacherous wretch, even if she is Beloved's get. Who knows what other blood is mingled in her? She's a mongrel from a tainted bloodline that has brought us nothing but disaster.
She shook her head, and her long silvery hair moved softly.
Dwalia, you have been gone from us for 3 years, and in those years the dreams of the Lurics have stacked and multiplied.
You speak of how you have shifted events to find this child, yet I know you have shifted them more than you can grasp. We are inundated with nightmares about the wrath of the unexpected son.